Hello, Joanna Geary from the Birmingham Post. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me about these things. And could you just tell us all who you are and what you do?
I'm Joanna Geary and I'm development editor for, well, I think technically now I'm development editor for BPM Media, which is a group of newspapers in the Midlands that comprise of the Birmingham Post, the Birmingham Mail, and the Sunday Mercury newspaper.
Excellent. Okay, so what does the term social media mean to you?
It's an interesting term. Social media means to me media that anybody can be a part of, and anybody's voice can be heard within, I think. Is probably the shortest definition I can come up with at the moment.
Okay, so it's a collaborative thing for you.
Not just collaborative. I mean, some people in social media are most uncollaborative people I've ever met. That's unfair. But a lot of it is just about. It's more collaborative than traditional mainstream media in the sense that it opens up the possibility for more than one voice to be heard, and that the voices that are heard are not dictated by ownership of any sort of distribution platform. So, for example, it's not just the people who own YouTube that get to put videos on YouTube, it's everybody, it's all the users. So, it sort of democratizes the use of media. That doesn't necessarily make it collaborative. It's the people that use social media that make it collaborative. You can use it to just shout at people if you want to, and many, many people do.
Okay, so what was your aha moment? That moment when you first felt, oh, this is something different, this is something worth exploring, something worth sticking with.
That's really hard because the whole process of discovering social media or different types of social media was a series of aha moments. I think the very first one was when I started my blog, and it was an accident. I didn't want anyone to know about it. It was a blog outside work. I just wanted to use it to experiment with the platform, and I really, 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 really didn't want anyone to know about it, except that I built up a blog roll on the very first day I did it. What I didn't realise was, of course, that meant that people who were in that blog roll would find out about me pretty much straight away, which they did. That was such a shock. I didn't realise how connected the software that blogs are built with made the world, really, or the application of blog platforms made the world. And that was a big moment, realizing just how interconnected things could be.
And that made you then decide that this was something journalistically worth sticking to, or were there other moments that maybe journalistically made you think that, yes, this is something that could be used?
Okay, as far as applications to journalism go, it was slowly as I built up that network of people through the blog. And through Twitter. This is one of the problems with convincing other journalists that social networks are a really fantastic place to do journalism because they're a fantastic place for journalism to take place in if you have the network of people in which you can rely upon to help you or provide sources for you, so on and so forth. So it wasn't really until I started building up that network of people first through the blog and then on Twitter did it start becoming a really useful tool for me. I think one of the things that's quite easy to establish early on, without necessarily being a big participant in social media, is it can be a resource for stories. So when I right at the beginning, I came across a blog called Created in Birmingham, which is an arts blog for the region, and at the time I was reporting on creative industries. So I saw that as an amazing resource for story ideas for the newspaper. Because what was happening was Created in Birmingham was able to cover, despite being a grant-funded blog with one person working on it, it managed to cover a vast array of different subjects that I just didn't have the time to cover in my particular role. All the space in the paper. It was one page a week. So I think I always saw it as a resource, but that wasn't a big aha moment. The aha moments were those when I realized that I had a network of people that I could rely on, I think. I suppose one of the big ones, and it's not really journalistically, but having learned the lesson, I think I then applied it to stories. And it was that the Birmingham Post website was being redesigned. And I, talking to a few friends who were in the creative industries, they had quite strong opinions about that and how they wanted their local newspaper website to be, so on and so forth. So on my blog, I put up a post saying, you know, would you like to help redesign the Birmingham website, Birmingham Post website? And if so, what do you want on it? And the response was amazing. Completely extended outside of the network of people I knew I would, were originally reading my blog. And we got so much feedback, we were able to create a sort of little mini manifesto with things that we promised we'd try and get into the new redesign or into the design of the paper website, the newspaper's website at some stage. So the power of that then went on to make me think about how I could use that in my job every day, I think. There was a lot of crowdsourcing of questions that I experimented with after that. Also sort of asking for, you know, seeking out experts or opinions, that sort of thing.
What tools do you use and for what? I remember reading one of your blog posts earlier where you described how you started your day, which was an interesting take.
I think that was a tweet. I can't remember which order it was now, unless I'm sitting down at my desk, I won't be able to track it. But I think I tend to check my Gmail account, which is my personal email, my Twitter, which is three different accounts, my personal Twitter, my professional Twitter, and then the newspaper's Twitter stream. I then check Facebook. And then after Facebook, I look at my work emails. That's the last thing that I'll check in the list. They tend to be the main places that I go for information, just to check what's going on, what people are saying.
Okay, so what tools do you use, and what do you use them for?
That's interesting. Are you talking about any sort of online tools? Because I always find it a little bit confusing when people talk about Web 2.0 and social media and then talk about apps that are very useful, but not entirely collaborative. But I suppose most of what I use is collaborative. There's two categories of things that I use. I use online tools to communicate with people on my network. And I use online tools to communicate information to people as part of my job, so as a way to sort of tell the story. On the first one, without a shadow of a doubt, the most useful one is Twitter for strengthening and communicating with my network. It's where people feedback to us on articles that they want to input into from the Birmingham Post. It's where people generally are there to ask questions of me, and where I get to ask questions of them. It's a very, very, very responsive tool. It doesn't take long before you'll get a reply from someone. I've got a good network now, so that's been really useful. Facebook's quite good too. And I've just really started getting into how I can use Facebook groups to get responses from people and sort of collaborate. But that's still kind of at the early stages, really. It's funny. It's been out for longer, but I'm probably not so good at using it. Then for the other thing, to communicate stories, we're quite big on live blogs in the Trinity Mirror Regional. So we use Cover It Live quite a lot, which is a lovely little tool and really enjoy using it. It's very easy to get other people, other journalists, to understand how it works and to get involved with it. So that's great fun, very useful. We use Dipity, which is a timeline tool, which is good, but I think there's space in the sort of timeline application market to perhaps make something that is a little quicker to compile and perhaps slightly more reliable. I'm sure Dipity will do it in time, and they've been fantastic with us, very, very helpful whenever something's gone wrong, so perhaps it will still be there in the future. Google Maps, of course. There's so many different little bits and bobs, you know, Flickr, it's really useful. I used to really like Sprout, which is a tool, a flash, to create little flash objects, that, you know, as widgets that can be put into website, embedded into websites, but like everything, eventually they have to make their money, and it's now pay for service, so sadly I don't think I'll be using it anymore, which is kind of sad and probably wrong, but unfortunately the way the web market works.
If you've touched on this slightly earlier, but if we go in a little more in depth to how you use Twitter, as Twitter seems to be the communication tool that a lot of journalists and a lot of other people are starting to use as one of their main short form communication systems.
How do I use Twitter? Well, I use Twitter for a number of things. Twitter is used to create news alerts for the Birmingham Post. So as stories are published to the web, they're then fed into our Twitter account, at Birmingham Post. I use it to communicate with the Birmingham community, the Birmingham Online community, the people who would know the parts of Birmingham that the Birmingham Post is covering, and understand the politics a bit more of it. So that tends to be through Birmingham Post, Joanna.
Could you give an example of maybe how you would use that particular sort of Twittering to reach what you would see as a target and engaged audience? What sort of discussions pop up around that particular usage?
As at Birmingham Post, Joanna?
Yes.
Generally, there's a couple, there can be lots of different things. If I see particularly good content around, or what I personally see as good content around the site, I'll flag it up. And occasionally that'll lead to debates and discussions on Twitter with people who either agree that what's said is very interesting or disagree. That's one particular way. Another is it'll be responding if someone, for example, has a gripe about maybe a particular story or a part of the website that maybe isn't working, then it's a really quick way for them to tell me that something's gone wrong and I can try and address it. So that's another way that it's used quite a lot. Let people know generally about what's going on in the Birmingham Post. We've recently done a support Jaguar Land Rover campaign, which we've done in tandem with a number of, in collaboration with a number of newspapers in our group, and I used Birmingham Post, Joanna, to explain that had happened, and to show people the links to our number 10 petition and our Facebook group for that. So it's sort of just letting people know what's going on in the paper, really, I think, more than anything.
You have, as you said, several different accounts. So your BAM Post, Joanna, is your account that's closely tied to your work as a journalist in the Birmingham Post. You then have your Joanna Geary account. And how would you use those differently?
I originally split them up because people who are interested in the Birmingham Post are not necessarily interested in the minutiae of my life. And I was getting people who were getting slightly annoyed by sometimes my Birmingham Post Joanna account sort of being hijacked by me when I was off on holiday or in a different place, or maybe in a conference that was related to my career rather than to the paper. And I got quite a few gripes and moans that their Twitter streams were hijacked by me talking about whether I could find enough coffee or something like that. So I split them off for that reason. Also because it's a difficult one to try and explain, but social networking is great, but you network for different reasons. I network on Birmingham Post, Joanna, with people who are interested in the Birmingham Post and my work within it. Joanna Geary networked because with people that are interested in me as my role as a journalist. So there's a lot more journalists, I think, that I follow on Joanna Geary, and I'll talk a little bit more about, you know, my thoughts on the industry and that sort of thing, which is not really my role to be doing as Birmingham Post Journal.
Do you think it's a good idea or a necessary idea or even a bad idea for reporters to have two accounts, to have a professional and a personal account?
I don't think it's completely necessary. I think it will become less necessary as people get to grips with the idea that now that communication is public, when we're talking about online communication, you have to accept that people are multifaceted. So, you know, someone you meet will not be professional 100% of the time. There's been this strange sort of acting going on, I think, because we could separate out our personal, well, not personal lives, but our more personal lives and our business lives, because we could always separate them and how we communicated to people within them. We never had to face the fact that, you know, sometimes someone who is ultra efficient at the work might wake up on a Saturday morning with a hangover, you know. I think we'll become more forgiving as time goes on. So I don't think it's totally necessary to separate accounts out. I would say I'm probably a heavier user than Twitter than a lot of people. And so it makes sense for me to separate out a lot of what I do. For example, a man was stabbed in King's Heath in Birmingham last night. I wasn't on duty at the time, but if I was, there would have been a Twitter that went out saying, you know, man stabbed in King's Heath. I'm not going to want to follow that by, I'm going down the pub now and, you know, I'm feeling a bit tired or just going to make a cup of coffee. It just feels a little bit wrong, a little bit flippant to me. But I use Twitter for both those things. So at least by separating out to Joanna Geary, you sort of stop those unfortunate clashes of content from occurring, or at least minimise them, I suppose.
Interesting. And I do think that that's a discussion that's going to continue in newsrooms, and in all probability there will be some policy discussion in newsrooms around this. You train journalists in using these social media tools. Has there been a discussion around whether or not there should be separate accounts, and do you advise the people that you train to have separate accounts, or to think about it, or not to have?
I don't advise them to have separate accounts, mostly because none of them reach the level of using Twitter at the moment to warrant having two accounts. And people are fairly cautious about what they write. I think at the moment, and I'm still kind of the belief that you really shouldn't. It sounds contradictory considering I have two accounts, but I don't think you should have to separate them out. So it's not something that we're sort of advocating at the moment.
Okay.
I think what we do say is, obviously, remember whatever you put online is public and searchable. So just remember who you are, what you do, and what you represent, and, you know, keep that in mind when you're using these tools.
On a related topic, there's a discussion now about whether there should be differentiated accounts or differentiated Twitter streams for news and conversation, where you would have one which is purely for headlines and stuff that's in the paper, and another one that you would then have for conversations around those areas. Where do you stand in that particular discussion, or have you thought about it?
So what you're saying is you'll have a Twitter stream, say like the Birmingham Post Twitter stream, where it's putting out automatically any news stories, and then you'll have a separate account to discuss those particular news stories.
Yes, where the separate account would be a journalist or journalists who would discuss it, whereas in the first case you just have a stream of information.
Right, okay. Well, first of all, I tend to enjoy discussing issues of the day with people, not with inanimate brand objects. So I think generally people prefer to have conversations about news stories with personal Twitter accounts, whether that be a journalist at the paper or one of their friends. So I don't think generally you'd want to have a conversation with an automatic Twitter feed, so the Birmingham Post. I think it's good to keep automatic feeds separate from personal ones, because I think both of them are used for two very different purposes. Not just for the fact that, you know, you mix up two completely different types of content by doing that, but also it's very difficult to repurpose that content if you start putting at replies and conversational pieces into a automatic Twitter feed. It becomes a bit more difficult to repurpose it. It depends. I mean, Jemima Kish, for example, seems to push out the PDA blog on her Twitter stream, but that's only about once a day. So the regularity of that doesn't really warrant having a separate feed. But the Birmingham Post Twitter feed, obviously, there's a significant number of stories going through there in a day. So I think it's better to sort of keep it separate.
Okay, if we leave Twitter alone for the moment, and I'd ask you if you could maybe give some examples of stories where social media has been instrumental in either breaking the stories and or following up the stories.
Well, our team of bloggers who for the Birmingham Post, who are not journalists, have broken a number of stories for us. We've had four front pages now generated from information that they've been writing in their blogs. So if you count that, then that is an example of how social media has influenced the news agenda for our paper. Just recently, there was a story that was written in the Birmingham Post about the closure of shops on Kingsheath High Street, which then made the national papers. That story idea, I believe, came out of conversations with between the editor and a number of local people on Twitter. So that prompted the story. I think there's still a bit of debate about how well that process worked and whether the paper did enough to credit the people in the conversation. I don't quite know how that has turned out yet. There have been people who have tipped us off about issues, which they've done so by sending a direct message to the Birmingham Post Twitter account. That's happened twice now on quite significant issues, which we've been able to follow up. I think in the last year, it's made a significant impact in lots of different ways to how we look at how we choose our stories. I think, you know, there's still the traditional routes and they're still the primary routes to news, but, you know, it has affected.
Could you maybe give us some quick background about your network of blogs? You've built up over, since your relaunch, you've built up a network of people blogging for the paper and on the paper, yet who are not journalists for the paper and who haven't any other connection to the paper.
Yeah, back in February last year, I was asked to set up some blogs for the Birmingham Post. I decided to look at creating blogs that brought in other people other than journalists onto the platform, and targeted it at business people, well-known bloggers who are already operating in Birmingham, and academics, people who would fit within the remit of the Birmingham Post readership. I wanted bloggers in there too because they knew what they were doing, and that was quite useful for people who'd never blogged before. And we set up three separate platforms, which were group blogs: the news blog, the business blog, and the lifestyle blog. We subsequently launched the sports blog as well. At the time, there was about 34 people writing for all of them. The reason we went I decided on a group blog was because we knew that these people who were volunteering to do it, and obviously choosing to do it because of the platform and exposure they'd get from the Birmingham Post, because it was still a voluntary thing, is going to be one of the first things that they put down if their life gets busy or things change. So we knew not all of them would stay with us. A significant proportion have, and now we're looking at how we move that forward, whether we give them their own individual blogs or we look at doing something extra with the platform and adding a few extra voices. So it's been, you know, we've learned a lot of lessons. There have been things that have gone wrong. There have questions being raised over how blogs fit into the general editorial sort of policy of the paper. Who owns the content? You know, what legal responsibility we have over them? How much influence we can have over them and the content that they write? It's been a really interesting ride. I'm not sure we've hammered out all the answers yet, but generally it's been very, very successful for us. In particular, one of the bloggers, David Bailey, who is the head of the University of Birmingham Business School, has received phenomenal interest from the writings that he has done on his blog. And it was his blog post that helped launch the Support Jaguar Land Rover campaign. So, which has seen, you know, over 6,000 signatures on a number 10 Downing Street petition.
It would be interesting to have a discussion around the lessons that have been learned, and particularly the editorial and legal ramifications and responsibilities, but we won't have that now. On, again, following up on that slightly, what ethical or etiquette do you think that journalists should use in mining social media? Because you're dealing with people who are now starting to, both the journalists themselves and the audience that the journalists have, or the collaborators that the journalists have, are opening a lot of areas that previously have been closed and seen as private and personal. For example, I know that there were issues around using people's memorials on Facebook, and those sort of issues. What are your views?
Well, if you're talking about specifically memorials on Facebook, that's
in general.
Okay. In general, I think, you know, you can't just take on social networks, you have to give as well. So, you know, for example, walking into someone's blog and ripping off everything they've said and not crediting them and not explaining what you're doing is generally bad practice. And I cringe at the idea of doing that. If you're talking about more serious cases where you're looking at Facebook memorial sites or perhaps even pictures of deceased people on Facebook, I think I slightly veer off of the general accepted idea, which is they have been published. They are public. If they've been made public, then you should be able to use them. I think you need to get permission from somebody connected to that person. It's not law, is it? So there's absolutely no reason why we should. But I have to think of it from a personal point of view. If it was a loved one of mine or if it was me. And I have actually written quite a long blog post about the fact that I have made my Facebook profile as private as possible in order to stop that sort of thing happening if I was to die in some horrendous circumstances. I think, though, unfortunately with that, the onus is on the public to realise the level of privacy they have on these networks and to act accordingly. But I think that won't happen until things go wrong.
Do you think that news organisations have a duty of care to their public, if you like, to explain more often the situation that people are putting themselves in when they leave their personal private details open?
I think a lot of newspapers cover that, probably more than they cover the benefits of the web, actually. I think it's one thing that's been discussed an awful lot in the UK media is the privacy issues surrounding the internet and the, you know, the possibility of identity theft. So I don't think the media is doing a bad job at communicating the risks of the web. I think maybe questionable whether they're properly communicating the benefits.
Good point.
If you are a trained journalist and your job is to track down information about a person on a story of importance, then, you know, if you find that information and there is no legal reason why you shouldn't use it, it's very hard to condemn people for doing that. You know, until society has made some sort of judgment on how it feels about that happening, you know, you can only really be guided by your own personal feelings on it, which is why I've said I feel uncomfortable about it.
Okay, if we move on to perhaps some examples of how stories have played out across stories that you would consider to be social media stories, and I know that that's a very broad term and a difficult term, stories that have a strong social media component, how they've played out across multiple platforms.
I have to be honest and say I'm not quite sure what you mean by that. You know, I can tell you about times when we've used social media and it's been successful, such as the launch of the Support Jaguar Land Rover campaign, and how the Facebook group has been a fantastic way of directing people to the petition that we've got on the Number 10 website, and that's obviously been very useful. We did the coverage of a debate on digital technology, and it was a relatively small debate. I think there was plans to have about 100 people in the audience. I think we managed to treble that by providing a live blog and a live stream of the event. So again, that sort of played out to a degree over social media, and we got a lot of feedback through that. I mean, maybe are you angling at the sort of stories that tend to be the A-list stories on Twitter about how good it is for journalism, which is the breaking news stories that have a national or international bent? So, for example, the big eye-opener for me was the UK earthquake, which shook me out of bed. And I was able to get a blog post giving information about the epicenter and, you know, sort of eyewitness accounts, so on and so forth, until probably about an hour before Sky News broke it. Obviously, that was a big eye-opener, and it was interesting to see the story develop over Twitter, people finding more and more information on the earthquake and sharing it with their networks. But first of all, there is no, I don't know, is there a social media, a story that works well with social media more than others? I don't know. Probably, if I have more time to think about it.
Sure. And again, I'm not particularly angling for anything. I'm just wondering about how you view these things, and I think that perhaps the Jaguar Land Rover story is classical campaign journalism mm-hmm. that now is able to possibly use new tools to be able to, instead of campaigning for, to be perhaps more able to campaign with.
No, that's been good, and it's kind of reassuring as well. Because you, as a newspaper, you want to be representing your community. You know, you do want to be doing the campaigns that are important to them. And that was a very, you know, seeing the reaction to the Facebook group was a very good indicator of just how much support was out there for that particular campaign.
And finally, what would you think were the basic tools that journalists need to know about, to be able to use, to navigate this new social media space?
My honest answer: curiosity. That's the basic tool they need. Curiosity and a lack of fear that they're going to break the internet. Because those two are the biggest barrier at the moment, I think, to people adopting tools. There are a million tools out there that may or may not be useful to a journalist. You know, I could give you the usual list and say, you know, they must understand blogs, they must understand Twitter, but they could really do with knowing how to use Google Maps. They must use you. Yeah, get some idea of how to clean up feeds with Yahoo pipes. You know, they've got to be able to understand the basic principles of an RSS feed and how that can help them with their job. They could use Google Alerts, you know. It'd be useful for them to know something about X Fruits or an equivalent, so that they could get things from RSS to email form or vice versa, or perhaps maybe Posterous, where they can put up bits of stuff on the web so they can link to it. But they should definitely know about Delicious. But the thing is, you can give people a list of things. It doesn't mean they're going to check it out unless they've got the right sort of mentality towards it. You can't integrate it into your life unless you're willing to play with it and be a bit curious and see how it might help you.
Thank you. That was very useful, and I really appreciate you taking the time to be able to talk to me and us, as I hope it will be. And thank you.
No problem.